Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Lila.
I'm Leo, and tonight we are going to bring you some news. Lots of news.
All kinds of good articles and lots of things going on in the world.
Well, you know, we can put this one. Kind of excited for Connecticut, actually, that they passed the marijuana, medical marijuana law.
And it went into effect today, the processing of it anyway. I don't think medical marijuana will be available to people. They said packaged until like January or February.
But nevertheless, it's still a good thing that, you know, it's coming along. And
a lot of other states are passing them.
Yeah, and
they're
making it a resolution on their ballots this year. And it says, a marijuana revolution in the making on Election Day. As we approach November, the leading Democrat and Republican presidential candidates remain conspicuously, though predictably silent, regarding the question of marijuana law reform. By contrast, much of the public and the mainstream media can't stop talking about pot politics. That's because voters in six states this November 6 will have their say on the subject. If President Bowles polled federal officials on November 7th, will have little choice but to acknowledge that they have a full-fledged reefer rebellion on their hands. Voters' impending rejection of the drug war status quo shouldn't come as a surprise, at least not to anyone who has been paying attention. Opinion polls over the past 12 months indicate record levels of public support for America's multi-decade failed experiment on cannabis criminalization. Are a majority of Americans finally ready to voice their drug war dissent at the ballot box?
In mere weeks, voters in six states will have that opportunity. Arkansas, for the first time ever, voters in southeastern United States will have the opportunity to strike a significant blow to decades of reefer madness. On November 6th, Arkansas voters will take to the polls to decide on Issue 5, the Arkansas Medical Marijuana Act. The act eliminates statewide criminal and civil penalties regarding the physician-recommended use and possession of up to 2 1/2 ounces cannabis for patients diagnosed with various medical conditions, including cancer, Crohn's disease, fibromyalgia, hepatitis C, post-traumatic stress disorder, Crohn's disease. The measure also allows state regulators to establish not-for-profit facilities to produce and dispense cannabis to those with their doctor's approval. Individuals will also be permitted to privately cultivate limited amounts of cannabis, up to 6 flowering plants, if they reside farther than 5 miles from a state-authorized dispensary. You could read the full text of this initiative, and they have it here. While no recent statewide polling is publicly available regarding this measure, nationwide surveys estimate that between 65 and 75% of the American public are in favor of allowing qualified patient access to cannabis. Historically, this support has translated to victory at the ballot box. Of the 17 states that allow for the limited use of therapeutic cannabis, 11 did so by voter initiative. Voters in Arizona, Maine, and Nevada have voted on two separate occasions in favor of allowing access to medical cannabis. Voters in the District of Columbia also took to the polls in overwhelming numbers to support a similar municipal initiative. By contrast, voters in only a single state, South Dakota, have ever rejected a medical cannabis measure at the ballot box. Colorado, among longtime marijuana law reform activists, all eyes this November are on Colorado in Amendment 64. Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol Act of 2012. If passed by voters this fall, the measure would amend the Colorado State Constitution to immediately allow for the possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana and or the cultivation of up to 6 cannabis plants by those aged 21 and over. It doesn't even say you have to be 6. Longer term, the measure seeks to establish regulations governing the commercial production and distribution of marijuana by licensed retailers. The act does not change existing medical cannabis laws for Colorado patients, caregivers, and medical marijuana businesses. It also prohibits the imposition of an excise tax on any retail sale of medical cannabis. Regarding the commercial production of non-medical cannabis, the Act requires the General Assembly to propose an excise tax of up to 15% on the wholesale sale of non-medical marijuana applied at the point of transfer from the cultivation facility to a retail store or product manufacturer. This proposed tax must be approved by a majority of voters in a statewide general election before it could be implemented. Non-commercial transfers of cannabis would not be subject to taxation. Major endorsers of the measure include the Colorado Democratic Party, the National Latino Officers Association, Blacks in Law Enforcement in America, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Colorado, Montana, Wyoming State Congress. Public sentiment in Colorado strongly favors the concept of treating cannabis in a manner similar to alcohol. A May 2012 Rasmussen poll reported that 56% of Coloradans supported legalizing pot like booze. Voters' support for the measure itself is also climbing steadily. According to a mid-September survey of USA poll of 615 likely state voters, 51% say they will vote for Amendment 64 versus 40% who say they will oppose it. That percentage is a marked increase from earlier polls, which had previously found support for A64 to be in the mid-40 percentile. Amendment 64 leading among voters by a 10-point margin. There is no reason to believe these most recent numbers will hold, if not improve. To date, there remains little public opposition to Amendment 64. The leading opposition group, Smart Colorado, has raised just over $150,000, mostly from disgraced drug warrior and Republican Party financier Mel Sembler. By contrast, the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol recently plunked down an estimated $800,000 worth of advertising, slated to begin airing in October. Massachusetts medical marijuana is nothing new in New England. Laws allowing for the therapeutic use of cannabis already exist in Connecticut, Maine, Rhode Island, and Vermont. Maine lawmakers further allow for the state-sanctioned production and distribution of medical pot, and similar proposals are now being implemented around the region. So it should come as no surprise that voters are rallying behind Question 3, the Massachusetts Medical Marijuana Act. The measure eliminates statewide criminal and civil penalties related to the possession and use of up to a 60-day supply of cannabis by qualified patients with cancer, HIV, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, and a host of other ailments. It also requires the state to create and regulate up to 35 facilities to produce and dispense cannabis to approved patients. Individual patients will also be permitted to privately cultivate limited amounts of cannabis if they are unable to access state-authorized dispensary. To date, the most vocal detractors of Question 3 are the heads of the Massachusetts Medical Society, the state's largest doctor organization. Ironically, the website devoted to the initiative is actually a spoof site designed by proponents of the measure. So far, the Society's criticisms have fallen on dead ears. According to statewide polls, voters support Question 3 has steadily risen from 53% in March to 60%, versus only 27% opposed today. Montana 2004, Montana voters approved ballot language to allow for physician-authorized use of cannabis by a vote of 62 to 38%, one of the most lopsided victories in a favor of marijuana law and reform on record. Yet rather than abide by the will of the voters, state lawmakers in 2011, led largely by an influx of newly elected Republicans, gutted the law by hastily passing Senate Bill 423. A previous bill to repeal the law completely was passed by the legislature, but ultimately voted vetoed by Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer. Passage of SB 423, which was recently upheld by the state Supreme Court, has led to a dramatic decline in the total number of patients enrolled in the state's medical cannabis program from high of 30,000 in June 2011 to fewer than 9,000 today. In addition, fewer than 400 medical marijuana providers are now registered with the state. But Senate Bill 423 these days may be numbered. On November 6th, Montana voters will take to the polls to decide on Initiative Referendum 124. A no vote on I-124 will repeal Senate Bill 423 and restore the state's longstanding medical marijuana law. Radio advertisements sponsored by the group Patients for Reform, Not Repeal, are now airing through the state, and early polling indicates that they may be having an impact on voters. According to a mid-September survey of 656 likely voters, fewer than half back I-124, which would keep SB 423 in effect, while 54% of the voters either oppose it or are undecided. Oregon was the first state in the nation to remove criminal penalties for minor pot possession offenses. This November, it may become the first state in the nation to legalize cannabis outright. Voters will decide on Measure 80, the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, by far the most liberal this year's pending statewide legislative initiative. The act allows for the relatively unregulated possession and personal cultivation of cannabis by adults while establishing statewide regulations governing the commercial production and sale of the crop. The measure also seeks to allow for the sale of cannabis for therapeutic purposes to qualified patients at cost, and allows for the production of industrial hemp. The measure faces an uphill climb. Campaign organizers remain short on cash, and Measure 80 trails slightly in recent polls. According to the latest Survey USA poll, 37% of respondents are backing the measure versus 41% opposed. The Survey USA reported a margin of error of plus or minus 4%, meaning that the contest is virtually a dead heat, and that those voters who are presently undecided about the measure will ultimately decide OCTA's fate. Predictably, support for the initiative is strongest among men and younger voters, indicating that the campaign still needs to win over females, parents, and seniors in order to be victorious. November, Washington. If one is to believe the latest polls, Washington will become the first state to re-legalize the adult use of cannabis by plebiscite. According to a just-released Survey USA poll, nearly 6 out of 10 voters now express support for Washington Initiative 502. According to the survey, 57% of respondents intended to vote yes. And this goes on. There's a...
Oh, one more page.
Yeah. Oh, let's talk about prominent supporters of this include two former U.S. attorneys, John McKay from the George W. Bush administration, and Kate Flumer, who held the job under President Clinton, as well as Seattle's former FBI agent in charge, Charles Mandigo. So they have some support for their legalization.
The editorial boards of the Seattle Times and Olympian have also endorsed the motion. If enacted, 1-502 would remove state criminal and civil penalties granted possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana by adults under 21.
No, age 21 or over.
I'm sorry. Okay. It would not alter existing state prohibiting regarding the private cultivation of cannabis for non-medical patients. You see, they nitpick this damn thing, you know, and it's driving you nuts. The measure does not amend any existing regulation regarding possession and cultivation of marijuana by qualified patients who are already permitted on the state to grow up to 15 plants and possess up to 24 ounces of cannabis. Controversially, I-5502 would impose per se traffic safety standards for anyone over 21 who operates a motor vehicle with detectable levels of active THC in blood.
Let's be like having alcohol.
Yeah. This provision would lower the legal standard necessary in Washington for a criminal DUI cannabis conviction from one that requires the state to show recency of marijuana use and a positive relationship between that use and behavioral impairment to one that merely requires prosecutors to prove that the defendant operated a motor vehicle with specific concentrations of THC in his or her blood. This provision would not alter the probable cause requirements that must presently be met before the state can legally demand the suspect's blood. Yeah, because you don't have to smoke, and you know that stuff stays in your bloodstream for 28 days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like you could be perfectly sober and still wind up with a bad blood test. So anyway, all kudos for the marijuana laws.
So there's a lot. And you don't hear a thing about it.
Well, mainstream media, they don't want to.
They don't say anything about it, but I think most American people would like to see it legalized.
I know they will. I mean, according to this, they do. You know, you got to understand, folks, you know, we've seen this so many times. What we hear on the news and what we see on the news and stuff is not what people are thinking. You know, most people think the same way, you know, in many ways. Like,
most Americans don't want to go to war. They don't want to take anybody's possessions. They
right.
don't want to kill other people's babies and kids. They don't want to do that.
They want to approve pot, you know, because over 100 million people smoke it regularly. Okay, so it's like, you know, take it out of the hands of the cartels and you know, and the corporations
and tax
right?
it
and tax it and let it be like liquor, you know.
Yeah.
But you know the biggest opponents
promote responsible use of it. You know, kids shouldn't be using it.
Well,
you don't want kids to drink either.
But the biggest opponents to this legalizing marijuana are the alcohol companies
and the pharmaceutical companies.
They don't want it because it'll kill their business. Because all you got to do is smoke a joint, and they'll cure you from cancer, or glaucoma, and every other known disease to mankind. Instead of taking $5 million worth of pills that kill you, all right? So it's like, and they know that. And cannabis was used well before 1937 when they banned it, all right? It was used for that for hundreds of thousands of years.
And quite successful.
And used as a medicine and healed people all over the world. And still does.
Well, how about this? Netanyahu and Romney have the same donors.
Yeah.
It doesn't really list them, but this was off of Press TV.
Yep. Netanyahu.
A new investigation reveals that 19 of the Israeli premier's wealthiest American donors have also given money to the U.S. presidential candidate Mitt Romney or to his Republican Party. The investigation carried out by the Israeli Haaretz newspaper found that 37 of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 46 donors during his battle for the leadership of his Likud party in January were Americans, and nearly half of those contribute either to the Republicans or to Romney, showing the Netanyahu's donor list does not include a single Democrat. The investigation asserts the premier's distance from the Democratic American Jews. This is while many in the U.S., President Barack Obama's Democratic Party, have criticized the Israeli premier for meddling in the U.S. election and siding with the Republican candidate, an accusation that Netanyahu denies publicly. Netanyahu's most well-known American supporter is casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, who also promised to spend up to $100 million to elect Romney. Adelson also finances the right-wing pro-Netanyahu daily Hayom, the newspaper, I guess. Also among Netanyahu's biggest donors was Ronald Plotkin, CEO of the internet-based employment agency Monster Worldwide. Netanyahu and Romney have more in common than just their financial supporters, longtime acquaintances from their shared past work at Boston Consulting Group in the 1970s, also see eye to eye on many issues, including the Middle East. Don't forget, Romney and Obama will be debating November 6th.
No, not November 6th. That's not right.
We'll challenge him. Well, the November 6th is the election.
Yeah, they're going to be debating tomorrow night.
They're debating tomorrow night. Sorry, I read the wrong thing there, folks.
Tomorrow night, which is really interesting.
That's going to be interesting. I hope everybody's going to watch that or at least listen to it.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Back to health. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy Labor Day. Why, in your estimation, is wheat so bad?
It's not wheat. It's an 18-inch tall plant created by genetics research in the 60s and 70s. This thing has many new features nobody told you about, such as there's a new protein in this thing called gliadin. We're not talking about gluten, so I'm not addressing the people who have gluten sensitivities and celiac disease. I'm talking about everybody else, because everybody else is susceptible, for instance, to the gliadin protein that is an opiate. This thing binds to the opiate receptors in your brain, and in most people stimulates appetite, such that you and I consume, on average, 440 more calories per day, 365 days per year. I bet you you're hungry right now.
I'm always hungry right now.
We just said the bagels on the front of the book here do look appetizing. That said, so it's not necessarily the wheat. It's the kind of wheat that we're eating.
That's right. It's not the wheat that Mom had. It's not the wheat that Grandma had. It's a very different genetically changed plant. By the way, this all predates the techniques of genetic modification. So these techniques were crude, imprecise, unpredictable, far worse than modern genetic modification. So the stuff we're sold, which no questions asked, is the product of research that occurred before the techniques of gene splicing. So this thing's very different, has many new, unique properties on humans, but the appetite stimulation effect is probably the most standout effect of all. But there are others.
Would it be possible to turn back the clock and go back to the old wheat? I mean, is that scientifically possible at this point in time?
It's very possible. It's economically unfeasible, probably, because this thing yields about tenfold more per acre. And so we'd have to ask farmers to take a loss in effect. We'd have to ask agribusiness to revert back to old seeds. They can do it. They probably won't do it. Now, we have sparked a movement, and we are having a lot of people. They're having record drops in sales because of this, because so many people. I think what's driving this is the tidal wave of change. If three people lost 8 pounds, well, big deal. This thing just dies and fizzles, right? But we're seeing hundreds of thousands of people losing 30, 80, 150 pounds, diabetics becoming no longer diabetic, people with arthritis having dramatic relief, people losing their legs swelling, acid reflux, irritable bowel syndrome, depression, on and on and on, every day.
So here's the question. If people want to start eating healthier today, then, and they can't afford to go to a specialty store, they can't afford to manufacture their own wheat, what do they start doing right now?
Eat real single-ingredient foods. Eat avocados, olives, olive oil, meats, vegetables. In other words, real food, the stuff that is least likely to have been changed by agribusiness, certainly not grains. So when I say grains, of course, over 90% of all grains we eat are going to be wheat. It's not barley. It's not millet. It's not flax. It's going to be wheat. So it's really a wheat issue. Wheat has been the recipient of this extensive set of changes.
And yet there are a lot of farmers who deal in these grains who would argue otherwise. The Mayo Clinic argues otherwise. They say you need a well-balanced diet, and that includes wheat.
That's right, because all that literature says, if you replace something bad, white and rich flour products, with something less bad, whole grains, and there's an apparent health benefit, let's eat a whole bunch less bad things. So I take Carrington unfiltered cigarettes, replace it with Salem filtered cigarettes. You should smoke Salems. That is the logic of nutrition. It is a flawed, deeply flawed logic. What if we take the next step and say, let's eliminate all grains? What happens then? Particularly eliminate this modern thing created by genetics research called semi-dwarf wheat. That's when you see not improvements in health, that's when you see transformations in health.
You gave me a weird look when I said I had a whole wheat bagel this morning.
Well, you're working, and you got away with it.
I was trying to fire up before the broadcast, but that, generally speaking, even the whole wheat, just to reiterate, you're saying is a bad idea.
It's a very bad idea. In fact, I'll say modern wheat is a perfect chronic poison. It causes diabetes, it causes inflammation, it causes heart disease, it causes high blood pressure. Just because whole grains are less harmful than white flour does not make it a good thing. So we've got to use a whole new brand of clear logic on this. If we eliminate grains, eliminate wheat really, specifically, semi-dwarf, high-yield wheat, that's when we see transformation. That's when you see all the diabetics get rid of their drugs. That's when we see with rheumatoid arthritis throwing away all their drugs for joint pain. That's when you see high cholesterol going away. You see incredible transformations in health.
Food for thought?
A lot of food for thought. Please avoid the breakfast tray in this room, if you would, Doctor. Thank you very
much.
That was pretty interesting, Leo.
Yeah. And I can attest to
well, you look
some of it, because I, you know, I...
You lost a lot of weight, but you gave up wheat because of gluten allergy.
I had a gluten allergy, and when I gave that up, I lost 30 pounds immediately. You know, I couldn't believe it. without changing. I mean, all I did was cut out wheat products, and it's quite a deal. Oh, this is a frightening thing.
Yeah.
A hog eats the farmer. Their farmer in Oregon. Hog eats the farmer.
They've kind of turned on him.
Yeah.
Terry Vance Garner, 69, never returned after he set out to feed his animals last Wednesday on his farm near the Oregon coast, the Coast County District Attorney said Monday. A family member found Garner's dentures and pieces of his body in the hog enclosure several hours later, but most of his remains had been consumed, District Attorney Paul Fraser said. Several of the hogs weigh 700 pounds or more. Oh, my God. It is possible Garner had a medical emergency such as a heart attack or was knocked over by the animals and killed and eaten, Fraser said, adding that at least one hog had previously bitten Garner. The possibility of foul play is being investigated as well. For all we know, it was a horrific accident, but it's so doggone weird that we have to look at all possibilities. A pathologist was unable to identify a cause or manner of death, the newspaper reported. The remains will be examined by a forensic anthropologist at the University of Oregon. Terry Garner was a good-hearted guy who cared for several adult sows and a boar named Teddy, said his brother Michael Garner, 75, of Myrtle Point. Piglets were typically sold to the local 4-H kids. These animals were his life, Michael Garner said. He had all kinds of birds and turkeys that ran all over the place. Everybody knew him. Michael Garner said one of the large sows bit his brother last year when he accidentally stepped on a piglet. He said he was going to kill it, but when I asked him about later, he said he had changed his mind, the brother said. Domestic hogs are not typically known to be aggressive as their feral cousins, but there is some degree of danger associated with any animal. John Kilfer, who heads the Animal and Rangeland Science Department at Oregon State University in Corvallis, told the newspaper. While pigs are more omnivorous than other farm animals, such as cows, Kilfer called the case highly unusual. Most hogs are raised until they reach a market weight of between 250 and 300 pounds. While breeding female pigs rarely weigh more than 400 pounds, Kilfer said.
Those pigs are 700 pounds.
They were 700 pounds.
Yeah.
I wondered what he was going to do with them. Several.
I have no idea.
I guess I didn't want to go to market. Yeah. We'll see what the video says.
Yeah, I repeat exactly that.
A small ranch on a state highway by the Coquille River near Riverton is now a crime scene. We want to be extremely cautious in what we are about to show you and what we are about to tell you, not only because of the graphic nature of this story, but there are animal carcasses laying across the yard for an unknown reason. 70-year-old Terry Garner was last seen last Wednesday heading out to feed his hogs. After a few hours, a family member went out to check on Garner, only to find his dentures in his hog enclosure. That family member then called law enforcement for help to find Garner. After further investigation, it was determined that parts of Garner's body were all over the enclosure and that Garner's hogs had actually begun to eat Garner's body. Now, authorities are leaning towards a heart attack or an animal attack as the reason for Garner's death. However, they say because of the strangeness of the situation, they are having a criminal investigator look into it from the Sheriff's Department. For now, in Riverton, I'm Ricky Marin on KVAL News.
Mm-hmm. Man, that's pretty bizarre.
It's very strange and a little bit scary, too.
Yeah, I mean, imagine.
I think
700-pound hog is a big.
Well, I wouldn't. He stepped on a piglet, but can you imagine if a 700-pound hog stepped on your foot?
Oh God!
It'd be crushed, and I don't think you'd get a hog off your foot either. They sound like they're bad tempered.
They're very vicious. They are. I had a friend of mine who had a pig farm when I was a kid, and I worked on a pig farm one year. One weekend with him. He invited me up there to work with him, and I did. And I'll tell you.
They're not very friendly?
No.
Probably mad. They don't want to go to slaughter. They're pretty smart.
Well, they don't know where the hell they're going. It's just that, the way they used to protect themselves is they used to have sledgehammers, okay? okay, on each post around the pen, around the big pen, where they kept their sows and boars and stuff. And because they would attack you. And the only way to stop an attack from a boar was to hit it over the head with a sledgehammer.
Oh, my God.
Right on the snout. You know, right on the snout, right on the head.
That sounds kind of vicious, Leo.
It would stun them, but it wouldn't kill them. It would stun them, you know.
And then you'd climb out of the pen and get out of there.
Then you get a chance to get out.
And your friend invited you up to help him with that?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
that sounds like fun.
Was, yeah, we were in high school together. And,
I'd be scared to death. Weren't you afraid?
Huh? Yeah. Yeah, especially when one came after me and my brother knocked it over the head with a sledgehammer.
He did?
Yeah, he jumped into the fence and said, run! Because those things, they're boars, they get teeth, you know, and they come after you. And they, you know, all I was doing was trying to feed it.
I guess it wasn't very grateful.
Holy crap. You know, I couldn't believe it. But, yeah, you know, these boars. And then I'll never forget the feeding time was unbelievable. You know, you throw the slop in these big troughs, and you get 100 pigs or more. And those damn pigs would come up, and they would bite each other to get to have the food. They would, you know.
Really?
Oh, they'd bite each other. They'd stomp all over each other. They'd crawl, you know. Oh, yeah.
And so eat like a pig is.
That's exactly. I mean, man, after a day with pigs, you realize what that means, like eating like a pig, you know, or being a pig. Pigs are a nasty little pig. They're nasty.
Oh.
Yeah, they're
Our friend has a potbelly pig, and they said their pig is sweet.
Yeah, well, you know, potbelly pig, I don't know. You know, if you...
She only weighs about 300 pounds, I guess.
Yeah, well...
Or whatever, 100 pounds.
Maybe, but I don't know. I'll tell you, you look at pigs and watch them eat.
I want to go to the
pig. What a pig, you know. That's the only thing you can say is, what a pig. what else we got here? There was something else I wanted. It was a good one I passed up here.
I want to go to the second page. There are several very good ones on page 2.
Okay. We already went through there. Okay. There was the one on the agriculture one.
We just did it.
Oh, there was another one. I guess not. Okay.
We're going to...
Sorry, folks.
Another
we
page.
Have to go to one more page on this blog.
Well, here's an interesting thing, and this might be coming to us. This is what's happening in...
What? Sorry, just hit that.
This is what's happening in the UK, and they're getting a huge tax. Fast approaching, if largely unnoticed, is yet another massive shock the government has in store for us. This is in the United Kingdom, with its weirdly distorted energy policy. It's surprising to see what an abnormally high proportion of the electricity needed to keep our lights on has lately been coming from coal-fired power stations. Last Wednesday evening, for instance, this was way over 50%, with only 1.3% coming from wind power. Yet by next March, we learned five of our largest coal-fired plants capable of supplying a fifth of our average power needs are to be shut down, much earlier than expected under the EU Anti-Pollution Directive. One reason why these plants are being hammered through their remaining quota of hours allowed by the EU is that a new UK tax comes into force next April, which aims to make fossil fuel power significantly more expensive. In 2010, George Osborne announced his intention to impose from April 2013 a carbon floor price of £16 in every ton of CO2 emitted by British industry, rising to £30 a ton by 2020 and £70 a ton by 2030. So all that's going to be passed on to the consumer.
Well, this is the carbon tax. I mean,
electricity,
I'm sorry to say, but the...
And that bankrupted Spain.
No, this is the...
Going green.
Going green. But this is going to bankrupt the world, and this carbon tax is absolutely absurd.
And this is what they say, yeah, they give all the things. Thus, to meet that tax level in the years after 2013, we in Britain will have to pay electricity bills soaring to a level far higher than any others in Europe. All this is to promote the building of thousands more heavily subsidized windmills, which will in turn require us to build more gas-fired power stations to provide backup for the constant fluctuations in wind speed. And these will be paying Mr. Osborne's fast-rising tax on all the CO2 they emit, with the bill to be picked up by the rest of us on a scale which, within 18 years, could alone almost double the cost of our electricity. In short, the Treasury has made an incredibly damaging miscalculation. Even if there's little chance that our Energy and Climate Change Secretary Ed Davey could get his head around such lunacy, perhaps someone might lay out for Mr. Osborne that the bill, his delusional new tax, is going to land us all. Might lay out for Mr. Osborne the bill that his delusional new tax is going to land us all with, meaning all of money and
right.
that we have to pay. It just is not phrased very well. The great Arctic ice scare melts away as the Antarctic ice hits record highs. In September 2007, when the summer melt reduced Arctic ice to its lowest level since satellite records began in 1979, there were hysterical predictions that within 5 years, thanks to runaway global warming, Arctic summer ice would have vanished completely. When NASA satellites showed last month that this year's ice melt was to break even the 2007 record, the same hysteria reoccurred. All the usual suspects, from BBC's Roger Harabin and The Guardian to Greenpeace and WWF, piled in to proclaim that the end was nigh. Professor Peter Wadhams, the tireless alarmist, intoned that the final collapse is now happening and will probably be completed by 2015 or 16. But then, as the sea recently began to rephase, NASA itself put up a video showing how a severe cyclone early in August had wreaked havoc on the ice cover, pushing vast amounts of it into warmer waters further south where it melted. A NASA surface temperature graph has long shown that the Arctic was considerably warmer in the 1930s than it has ever been since. Furthermore, what the warmest scaremongers always forget to tell us is the polar ice at the other end of the world has been reaching record highs in recent years. Last week, Antarctica's sea ice area was only just short of the greatest extent ever recorded at either pole. A graph on the science blog, What's Up With That?, charting the combined global sea ice over the past 33 years, shows the overall extent having remained virtually constant since 1979, but isn't the point about the warming that is meant to be global? Don't expose aid corruption or DFID will follow you.
We'll fire you.
Why don't you read that?
One man who has followed this particular interest, the Sunday Telegraph's exposure of waste and corruption in aid programs, sponsored by the Department of Energy and Environment, is Howard Horsley, whom I wrote about here in August 2005. In 1999, having won plaudits as headmaster of one of the toughest comprehensive schools above, coming to London himself, however, Mr. Horsley met with a response of, this is all bullshit. I don't care about this.
War means less to Maud. While the slow-motion train wreck of the Eurozone continues, the £14.4 billion our government borrowed in August set a new record for that month, confirming a public spending deficit, the one that the BBC tries to ignore as the highest in Europe. In July, when I asked Francis Maude how Francis Maude could claim he was slashing the government deficit after months when it has been having to borrow more than £4 billion a week, the office of the Deputy Prime Minister instantly demanded a correction. The government, it insisted, was indeed cutting the deficit, even though it was still rising, a point repeated by Mr. Maude himself in a letter we published the following Sunday. To claim that the government is cutting its deficit when the gap between its spending and its income grows even greater sounds like a kind of thing that Alice heard after stepping through the looking glass. Doesn't that sound very much like what's going on here, too?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on.
So we learned it from the Brits.
Well, we're it's a worldwide bullshit. Now, it's a worldwide conspiracy, basically. And trying to find, let's see, we got about another 15 minutes. Jesus, I hate that machine.
Well, okay. you're not
I
doing
really
it
do.
Properly. Yeah, keep your hands off it. George Carlin, here's this. He said religion is bullshit. All kinds of things that God said.
Yeah. Let's see. What was that?
Drug companies pushing to replace nutrition with pharmaceuticals. Take your medication even if you don't have any symptoms.
Right.
Medications and nutrition, that's the essential rationale behind a couple of big pharma corporations' decision to give a failed Alzheimer drug a second chance. In early August, Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson said they were ending large-scale clinical trials of their experimental drug, bapineuzumab, in patients with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah,
because patients taking it did not show signs of improved memory or thinking skills. That was disappointing to millions of Alzheimer's sufferers and their families, though the results of the trials were all but expected by researchers and investors to go well, who believed the drug had little chance. Now, that doesn't make sense. That was disappointing to millions of Alzheimer's sufferers and their families, though the results of the trial were all but expected by researchers and investors who believed the drugs had little chance to succeed. I don't know how they write some of these sentences. They
don't understand.
It's very
that
awkward.
Yeah.
In other words, they didn't expect it to succeed, but they got people to invest in it. Is that what they're saying?
Yeah. Disappointing to, let's read that
such,
one.
I read it twice. Such pessimism is driven by a new belief among scientists who think that the disease is actually a decades-long process in which the toxic protein beta amyloid gradually builds up in the brain before dementia sets in. So they you really have to find out what's happening 20 years before.
Yeah.
The belief has this that belief has led scientists to conclude, therefore, that clinical trials for new Alzheimer's drugs should be concluded years in advance, before the gene has had a chance to do its damage, before the disease has had a chance to do its damage. Though some experts think that Big Pharma will balk at such a notion after already spending billions on a failed drug trial.
Neither company. Yeah.
Well, here's more on the research. Antioxidants and other natural nutrients.
According to prior Alzheimer's research, evidence shows that the buildup of a beta amyloid plaque is a major component of the disease. They show that high levels of beta result in neuronal cell death.
Huh.
According to the National Center of Biotechnology Information of Bethesda, Maryland. In addition, researchers have found that the beta amyloids can increase in the absence of friendly
endothelial nitric oxide, which is essential to the proper function of our vascular system.
While more research is needed, some studies have shown a relationship between the disease and the chemical resveratrol,
which can increase ENOS and thereby lower levels of plaque seen in Alzheimer's.
There is more causal evidence. And this is our data suggests the nitric oxide plays an important role in modulating APP.
That's amyloid precursor protein.
expression and processing with the brain and cerebrovasculature. Is that right?
Yes, cerebrovasculature.
There you go.
One study about well, it's the brain.
Lila takes such pride in
other evidence suggests that the naturally occurring antioxidant carnosine can also drastically reduce the formation of beta amyloid plaque, as can curcumin, the primary ingredient in curry. How about that? Research is ongoing, but it seems odd to try to replace a nutrition-based solution with an unproven medication that could have damaging side effects.
Sounds right to me.
Yeah.
You can get that at naturalnews.com.
So we should eat plenty of curry. Maybe the Indians don't. From India don't have
Alzheimer's.
Much Alzheimer's because they eat a lot of curry.
Yeah. There's one more I wanted to talk about on this nutrition before we...
We only have about 10 minutes left to the show.
This one is another Natural News article, but mainstream media called out for a complete blackout on GMO health risks.
Yeah, they don't say a word.
They don't talk about GMOs at all, anywhere in the United States news at all. And you don't even hear the word, you know. The recent release of a first-ever long-term study to examine the consequences of prolonged consumption of genetically modified organisms has set the world ablaze, with individual citizens and even government officials now calling for immediate embargo on all things GMO. But strangely silent in all this has been the Times, the Guardian, the Independent, the BBC, and various other mainstream groups based in the UK, and none of which have bothered to even mention this study in any of their reports. And it's the same in this country. They do not mention GMOs in this country. The result of the study, which Natural News has already covered extensively, were so shocking that even many mainstream media outlets in the U.S. covered them, although with plenty of obvious bias. Even so, the UK media the UK-based media has largely ignored the findings altogether, which most certainly call into question to whom their allegiances lie, and with the people or with the biotechnology industry who appear to be trying to protect them. Trying to protect from public scrutiny, yeah.
Those newspapers have reported on small 12 GM research trials about purple tomatoes, blood oranges, and cooking oil, as if civilization depended on such things. That they completely ignore this new research, which reveals significant health risks and inadequacy of the GM regulatory system, writes Lawrence Woodward for NYR Natural News. The research on rats carried out at the University of Caen in France found that GM maize sprayed with Roundup, and Roundup itself causes tumors, multiple organ damage, and premature death. All those media sources that did give the research at least a cursory mention, many peppered their reporting with doubt and skepticism about the legitimacy of the research, with the exception of the UK's Guardian, which published an editorial urging regulators to take the research seriously. Industry-backed American media largely ignores GMO study, dismissed it as invalid.
Sadly, the situation is not much different in the U.S., except for the fact that the mainstream media there, when it did report on the study, largely dismissed it as invalid. Even though the research was conducted in accordance with the generally recognized protocols of studies of this nature, industry-backed corporations like Forbes, Slate Magazine, and CBS News, among many others, basically insinuated that the research could not be trusted. Forbes, for instance, ran a headline against the question, "Does genetically modified corn cause cancer? A flawed study fails to convince." And Slate ran the obnoxious little gem of a headline, "GMO opponents are the climate skeptics of the left," followed by the unbelievably false and incendiary statements urging readers, "Don't worry, genetically modified corn isn't going to give you cancer." But that any so-called journalist would dare make such an inane statement in light of the new research, regardless of any potential flaws it may or may not have, is highly irresponsible. And since not a single long-term study other than this one has ever been conducted on the safety of GMOs, and not a single study ever has proven GMOs to be safe, how exactly is it that in any way, scientific or rational to tell the world that eating GM corn will not cause them to develop cancer? And to learn more about the many documented dangers of GMO, visit responsibletechnology.org/GMO-dangers. And I think that would be a really interesting one.
If you can't remember that, just go to Natural News.
Yeah, and that might be a really interesting one to look at for them.
We're going to look at it ourselves here.
Responsible Technology, Institute for Responsible Technology. The Academy of Environmental Medicine doesn't think so.
Genetically modified are they safe?
The American Academy of Environmental Medicine doesn't think so. The Academy reported that several animal studies indicated serious health risks associated with GM foods, including infertility, immune problems, accelerated aging, faulty insulin regulation, and changes in major organs and gastrointestinal system. And the AAEM asked physicians to advise patients to avoid GM foods.
How about this? Since the findings include thousands of sheep, buffalo, and goats in India died after grazing on BT cotton plants.
But it says before the FDA decided to allow GMOs in the food without labeling, FDA scientists had repeatedly warned that GM food can create unpredictable, hard-to-detect side effects, including allergies, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. They urged long-term safety studies but were ignored.
Mice after eating GMO corn from the long-term had fewer and smaller babies. More than half the babies of mothers fed GM soy died within 3 weeks and were smaller. Testicle cells of mice and rats on GM soy changed significantly. By the third generation, most GM soy-fed hamsters lost their ability to have babies. Rodents fed GM corn and soy showed immune system responses and signs of toxicity. Cooked GM soy contains as much as 7 times the amount of known soy allergen. Soy allergy skyrocketed by 50% in the UK soon after GM soy was introduced. The stomach linings of rats fed GM potatoes showed excessive cell growth, a condition that may lead to cancer. Studies showed organ lesions, altered liver, and pancreas cells changed enzyme levels. Unlike safety evaluations for drugs, there are no human clinical trials of GM foods. The only published human feeding experiment revealed that genetic material inserted into GM soy transfers into bacteria living inside our intestines and continues to function. This means that long after we stop eating GM foods, we may still have GM proteins producing continuously inside us. This could mean if the antibiotic gene inserted into GM crops were to transfer, it could create super diseases resistant to antibiotics. If the gene that creates BT toxin in GM corn were to transfer, it might turn our intestines bacteria into living pesticide factories.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Although no studies have evaluated if antibiotic or BT toxins gene transfer, that is one of the key problems. The safety assessments are too superficial to even identify most of the potential dangers for GMOs. And it says, see our health risk brochure and state of the science report. And I'm going to advise you to go to this website. It's called the Institute for Responsible Technology. And I think you'll be impressed. I was.
Now, we only have 1 minute left, Leo.
GM corn damages liver and kidneys. Meat raised on GM feed is different. Roundup could cause birth defects. Genetically modified soy leads to sterility. Damaging effects of Roundup. GM crops do not increase yields. GMOs inevitably contaminate and persist. Industry studies are flawed. Those are just some of the articles that they have on that site.
And
yeah, I highly recommend you.
We want to thank you for listening to us tonight and hearing the news, and stay tuned for tomorrow night when we're focusing on the unions and their issues. And we have Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Council 4, on our show to discuss union issues.
Yeah.
And also to talk about the various candidates for election and how things are going.
Yeah.
So we hope to be talking to you tomorrow.
Yeah, so good night, everybody.
Good night, folks. Have a great night.
Good night.